Stereo Theater presents The Scales of Justice.
Okay, just pull over and stop. Just up there.
Before the driver.
Yeah, anywhere along here. Just park the car.
You live over here, Vic?
No, a couple of blocks away.
What? What are we doing?
Don, listen to me. We do this my way, or we don't do it at all. I just don't want you meeting her. She's got a kid. I don't want her to get any more involved than she is. You understand?
Okay. Does Vic?
No buts, Don. I want you to give me the money here, and I'll go get the stuff for you.
A friend? You want me to front the money?
Don, if you don't like it, we can go home now.
Not the way I like to do business. But I trust you. I trust you.
60, 80, 100. All right. The deal is $100 for a gram of coke, right?
That's the deal.
All right. I'll be right back. You just stay here.
I ain't going nowhere, Victor. Welcome back. No?
Yeah, I got it.
Where?
In my pocket.
Why don't you give it to me?
Right here?
Let's do what you prefer.
For God's sake, Victor, take it easy.
My spoon has been waiting a long time, you know that?
Okay.
Good man.
God.
Long time. That's good stuff. Victor, I'm very happy with you. What?
No, I don't. I just want to get back to my car. Can we go?
Sure. No problem. Good. I can see you go all with it.
Don, I told you this was a favor, a one-shot deal. I don't...
Hey, old plan, wait a minute. Let me tell you. My old man's got a line and a couple of new cars coming in from overseas. Class machines. If you're interested, you can drive out to Surrey as soon as you're in. You want to take a look? Okay.
Yeah, sure, Don. You know I like to see the car. Sure, call me. But not about this stuff, Don. You just call me about the car.
Sure. No problem at all.
$100 for a gram of cocaine. A small transaction by any standards, let alone those of the high-powered drug world of Vancouver, where this deal took place in September of 1977. What Victor Amato, a 26-year-old hairdresser, didn't know was that Don Langvin, his new friend, a man with a very expensive cocaine habit, also happened to be a paid police informer, a tool in the RCMP's ongoing war against drugs in Vancouver. Amato was to be involved in two more transactions. He and his supplier, a former girlfriend named June Lee, were to stand trial before a judge sitting alone in the British Columbia Provincial Court. It was, in many ways, a very small matter. Why, then, are we examining it on the scales of justice? Because every person in that provincial courtroom knew that the case was not going to stop there. And before the Amato case was over, it would have changed the law in this country while leaving the Supreme Court of Canada as sharply divided as it had ever been in its long history. My name is Edward Greenspan, and the story you are about to hear has been reconstructed from the transcripts of the trial in the British Columbia Provincial Court and the judgments in the British Columbia Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court of Canada.
The Scales of Justice, a series recreating real events in Canadian crime, with commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In this episode, you will hear Jeff Bowes as Victor Amato in the true story of Snow Job, written by Guy Gabriel Kay and produced by George Jones.
In June of 1977, the RCMP were escalating their war on the drug dealers of Vancouver. When the Amato case ended up in court, Victor Amato's lawyer, Sid Simons, put his client on the stand to tell the story of how he got caught up in that war.
Mr. Amato, where were you employed in June of 1977? A hairdressing salon called Crimpers in North Vancouver. I've been there 7 months.
And who was the manager of the shop?
He was a fellow named Andre.
Now, in or around June of 1977, did you have a conversation with this fellow Andre?
Yes, I did. It was while I was working in the shop one day.
Hey, now it's
killing us. Hey, Betsy, yeah, I'm just finishing. Half a sec.
Is that okay, ma'am?
Yes. Yes, fine. I like it.
Great. Sue at the front desk will take care of it. Oh, thank you, ma'am. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I'll see you again.
You're good with the ladies, Victor. You're doing good work.
Well, I've been at it for 7 years. You learn, huh? What's up?
Come on into the office for a second. I wanted to ask you a favor.
Sure.
I got a good friend named Don. He asked me to scout around for him for... Well, he's new in North Van, doesn't know many people, and he wants to score a little coke. Cocaine.
Well, really, I don't know where I could get any. I mean, I think you don't know anything about it. I mean, I don't understand why you're asking me.
Well, you know a lot of people, it looks like. He's a good buddy of mine, and he's been bugging me about this for a while. And I told him I'd do some checking, you know.
Yeah, sure, but I don't know anybody where I could get cocaine. Well, I keep my ears open if you like, but this is really like outside my...
Mr. Amato, until that time, had you ever used cocaine?
Never.
Had you ever trafficked in cocaine?
Never.
Had you ever obtained any for anyone?
Never.
Shortly after this conversation, Victor Amato left Crimpers and went to work for another salon in the same area. And very shortly after he got there, he received a phone call.
Victor, are you free? Phone call for you.
Thanks.
Hello.
Victor Amato?
That's me.
Hey, Victor. My name's Don Langford. I got your number there from Andre at Crimpers. He's a good buddy. An old friend of mine. I think he may have mentioned me to you.
Yeah, he did, but listen.
Victor, you know, Andre spoke very highly. He said you were someone to be counted on. See, I've only been in this part of town for a little while. Andre's the only guy I know well, and, well, I really badly want to score a gram of coke. Andre said...
Hey, for God's sake, I'm at work here. Listen, Andre is just mistaken. He's mistaken if he told you I could help. I don't know the slightest thing about this kind of stuff. And frankly, it seems stupid for us to be even having this conversation like this. I don't even know you at all.
I'm a friend of Andre's for a couple of years now. But Victor, really, I just don't know where to turn. I don't know anyone in this area, and I'm getting a little desperate to score a gram if you want me on the truth.
I don't want anything. I don't want to know about this. Listen, I'm sorry. I got to get back to work. I'm sorry. I can't help you. Goodbye. Victor, how you doing?
Good. How's life down the street?
Yeah, fine. Sue, is Andre around?
You don't want to talk to me anymore? Hold on, he's right here. Andre, Victor Amato.
Victor, what's up? Ready to come crawling back?
Andre, I just got a call from this friend of yours, Don Langvan.
Yeah.
Andre, what is this? Who the hell is this guy?
Calm down. Yeah, give me your number, Victor. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, just...
Don's okay, I told you. He's one of the guys. We shoot pool every Sunday.
Andre was later to say that he put Don Langvan in touch with Victor Amato simply to get Langvan off his own back. It seems clear that Andre's involvement in this matter was quite innocuous, but it also became very clear that there was a lot he didn't know about his pool-playing friend Don Langvan. Langvin's true role emerged in court during Sid Simon's examination of RCMP Corporal James Tate.
Don Langvan was acting as an RCMP informant, was he not?
Yes.
And the function of an informant is to introduce the undercover policeman to persons who are traffickers.
That is correct.
Not to make traffickers of them, then.
That is correct.
And that would be a clear instruction you would give Langvan, wouldn't it?
Yes.
This, as Amato's lawyer knew very well, was a critical issue. Simons pressed on.
Was Langvan given an operative number?
Yes, he was.
You knew that he was a user of cocaine?
Yes.
While he was acting as your operative?
Yes.
Do you know how much he was paid for his work on this operation?
Yes.
How much?
I really don't think that's relevant.
Well, perhaps His Honor will be the one to decide that, witness. And would you please answer the question unless His Honor tells you you need me?
Your Honor...
Your Honor, the Crown objects to that question. Obviously, this witness feels it's confidential police
all
information.
All kinds of things are confidential police information.
Just a minute, just a minute. Why are you objecting, Mr. Kennedy?
Oh, well, the witness seems to feel it's confidential information, which for some reason might...
All right. Corporal... Why is it confidential information?
I just think that for the protection of future informants, as little as possible should be divulged. However, if Your Honor directs me, I will oblige and tell it.
All right. Tell me, please.
He received $200 a week.
Thank you. Where does he live now?
I have no idea.
I see. Was one of the arrangements made with him that he would have the opportunity of relocating somewhere?
Yes, for his safety, of course.
All right. And that's a government expense?
No. He was given a final award, and what he did with it was up to him.
How much was he given?
$9,500.
A fair moving bill, eh?
Yes.
And you have no idea where he's living now?
No, sir, I do not.
So you couldn't, even without telling me the address, go serve a subpoena on him to come to court and testify?
No, sir, I could not.
And who can?
I know of no one who can.
You mean no one in Her Majesty's RCM police knows the whereabouts of Donald Langdon?
I don't believe so. I don't know, and know of no one who does.
And so, by the time the Amato case came to trial in 1978... Don Langdon was nowhere to be found, and this would have important consequences. Back in the summer of 1977, though, he was very much in the picture, as Amato told his lawyer in court.
He must have called at least 15 or 20 times. Most of the calls were at work during the day.
Had you ever asked him to call you?
No. He said he was still looking for a gram of cocaine, and when I tell him I didn't know why he was calling me, he changed the subject, like, to cars. He said his dad imported these cars from England and that he had good deals on them, and if I ever needed a good buy, I could count on him. He was more or less befriending me at this point.
And did you have any intention of obtaining cocaine for him?
No, not at all. I was trying to be a friend with him because he just seemed like a person I probably benefit from. And he just seemed like an all-around nice guy on the phone. See, to me, it didn't dawn on me that... All right.
Did he ever come to your shop on any occasion?
Yes, he did. It was sometime in August.
Hi, can I help you?
Hi, is Victor Amato here?
Yes, he is. Do you have an appointment?
No, I just got my haircut. No, I'm a friend of his.
Okay, just a sec. I'll get him. Victor!
Yeah. Yeah, you want to see me? Victor? Hey, how you doing? I'm Don Langdon.
Oh, hi.
Hey, you got time for a coffee? I figured you were right. I mean... Crazy for us to be talking on the phone. I mean, you don't know me from a hole in the ground, right?
Right.
So I thought I'd cruise down here. I just got a new set of wheels for my dad anyhow. Grab you for a quick cup of coffee. What do you think?
New wheels, huh? Where'd you get that Rover you were talking about?
Sure did. Parked right outside. Can you take half an hour?
Yeah. Yeah, I can. Just give me 5 minutes to finish something, okay?
Did you see his car?
Yes, I did. It was a Rover. It's a very rare car. It was like an antique. We went inside the car, and he was showing it to me, the wood paneling on it. And he was telling me about the deal his dad had gotten. He said if I was interested, I could count on him to see what he could find out for me.
And was there any further conversation about cocaine?
Yes. He mentioned that he was still looking for a gram of cocaine at that time.
All right. And did you agree to see if you could find him some cocaine?
I told him I would ask friends around and see if I could turn him on to someone.
All right. And did you ask around?
Yes, I did.
Why were you willing at this time to do this?
Well, because he'd been calling me every day for weeks, and I was more or less trying to get a friendship happening with him.
All right.
And who did you call?
I called June Lee, who used to be my girlfriend, and we still kept in touch. See, I knew her brother was a heroin user, and I figured June could call his girlfriend. Her brother was in jail at that time. And maybe his girlfriend could help us get a gram of cocaine for Dawn. So, but the middle of August, I called her.
Hello?
Hi, June. It's me. How are you doing?
Hey, we're fine. What's happening?
Not a lot, actually. Just called to say hello.
Oh. Well, how's work? The new job?
Oh, work's fine.
Good.
I made a new friend.
Oh, you're calling to tell me you've got a new lady?
No. It's a guy.
Victor.
What? Oh, nothing like that. You should know better.
I do know better.
he's a cool guy, and he may be useful, too. His father's got a line on cars from overseas. He seems to know some interesting people, but... Mm-hmm. Well, he's new in the area, and... Well, June, he's been on me all summer about trying to get a gram of cocaine.
What? Victor...
So I thought maybe just this once as a favor, you could call up Judy, you know, your brother's girlfriend, and maybe one of her friends could help out, because, like, Don, that's my friend, he's really desperate to get this gram.
Victor, why do you want to get involved with something like that for?
I know, but, well, he's really desperate. He's been on me so much, and, like, I think if I do him the favor, it could really benefit me to have him as a friend.
Oh, Victor, I don't like this at all. No, why the hell should I get involved in this just so that you can make a new friend?
I know, but June, listen.
Listen, if you want to call me to talk, to keep in touch, that's fine. That's good. But if you're just phoning to use me like this, well, don't bother.
Oh, Christ.
What happened next?
I got back to Don, and I told him I couldn't help him. And he said, could I just keep trying, please? And he said he'd be keeping in touch.
Mm. And did he keep in touch?
Oh, yes. He just kept on phoning.
And did you again contact June Lee?
Yes, I did. I had to make 3 or 4 calls.
And what was her response?
Well, she kept asking me why she should stick her neck out for someone she didn't even know.
But eventually, did she agree to help you?
Yes. After I persisted for a while.
And what was arranged between yourself and Don?
It was arranged that I meet him at the corner of Cassiar and Hastings. There was no way I was going to let him know where I was going to get his stuff, because I wanted to protect June and her kids. So when we drove out to her area, I made him park 2 or 3 blocks away from the house. He gave me $100. I went to June's. I picked up the gram of cocaine, I came back out, and I gave it to Don.
God. Well done. That's good stuff. Victor, I'm very happy. What?
No, I don't. I just want to get back to my car. Can we go?
And that, of course, was the transaction we heard at the beginning of this show. In court, Sid Simons asked his client some important questions.
What happened to the $100?
I gave it to June.
Did you make any profit of any kind on that incident?
No.
Did you intend to?
No.
Did you get any cocaine?
No.
Did you intend to?
No.
By the time the case came to trial, Don Langvin had, as we know, disappeared, with the RCMP's consent and financial support. As a consequence, there was no one to give evidence against D'Amato about this incident, and no charges were laid with respect to it. As we shall see, the situation was to change very quickly.
Mr. D'Amato, did you hear from Langvin again?
Yes, I did. He came to my apartment a couple of days later.
And what was your discussion at that time?
He said he was in the vicinity and that he got my address from Andre, and that he wanted to invite me to this party that was happening toward the end of the month, end of September, out in Surrey.
And who was going to be attending this party?
He said he had some friends coming up from California.
All right. And was there any further conversation about cocaine?
Yes. He asked if I could look into my source, if my source could get him 1/2 ounce for this party. And I immediately said no.
Did you hear from him again?
The next day. He called me at work. He said he needed a favor.
Oh, so, Victor, really, I need this favor. I need it bad. Now, these guys are coming all the way from California for my party.
They're going to expect me to have some snow for them. I just got to get some.
No way. Absolutely no way, Don. I only did it one time as a favor for you. Look, I don't know anything about dealing in cocaine. Frankly, the whole idea scares the hell out of me. I don't want to get involved. You understand? I'm a hairdresser. That's how I make my living, and I'm happy to keep it that way. Now, I got a class. Goodbye.
But this outburst did not deter Don Langdon, who seemed determined to earn the $200 a week the RCMP were paying him. He started calling Victor Amato on a daily basis at Amato's place of work. If Amato refused to talk to him, he just called back. This went on all through September. On the 3rd of October, Langdon increased the pressure a little more.
On that day, he came down to the shop and we went out back and sat in his car.
Was there any conversation about cocaine?
Yes, there was. He said his friends were in town for the party. He said they were in town and waiting, and he begged me to do everything in my power to get him the half ounce of cocaine that night.
All right. Did you agree then to do what you could?
I said I'd call. I told him there were no promises, but I said I'd call.
And did you call June Lee again?
Yes, I did.
Hello?
Hi, June. It's me. What's happening?
Not much.
Yeah, me neither. Things are quiet. No real news. Except this guy, Don Langdon. He's asked me to do him another favor. He wants half an ounce of cocaine for this party.
God damn you, Victor. Screw off. I don't like this one bit. I don't
June,
want you
June, for God's sake, don't get so freaked out. Just cool down, for Christ's sake. Now, listen. Everything's cool. I know this guy, and these are good friends of his. They're up here for a party. They just want this half ounce for the party they're having in Surrey.
Victor,
and, June, please, do me this last little favor. I promised him I'd try. I won't do it again. This will never happen again.
Oh. Were you able to persuade her?
After a few phone calls that day.
And what arrangements were made for that evening?
I told Don to meet me in the Safeway parking lot at Cassiar and Hastings.
Was there any discussion about price?
Yes, there was. I believe it was $1,100 for the half ounce.
All right. Were you intending or expecting to make any profit from this transaction?
No, I was just getting this price from June's friend, and I just relayed it back to Don, and he said, well, that sounds pretty fair to me.
All right. Who were you expecting to meet that night in the Safeway parking lot?
Don.
Were you expecting anyone else?
No, I wasn't.
And when you arrived there, what happened?
When I arrived, there was no one there. I waited about 15 minutes, and then a car pulled up. I was expecting Don's Rover, but a beige Monza came instead. I saw Don in the passenger seat, and he waved me to come over to their car, and so I got out of mine, and I walked over.
Victor, good man. Come on, get in. How are you doing?
Who the fuck is this guy? For Christ's sake,
hey,
Don.
Hey, it's okay. I'll cool down, Victor. I want you to meet my best friend, Gary. Gary, this is Victor.
How you doing, man?
Son of a bitch, Don. God damn it. What are you bringing other people in for? You said this would be between me and you and no one else.
Well, there's no way. There's just no way this is going to happen now.
Hey, Victor, he's my best friend. Will you just
look, I don't care. How do I know who this guy is?
Hey, Victor, for God's sake, just cool.
Don, I was doing this as a favor, a personal favor for you, and I you changed
hey,
the whole
hey,
concept.
Hey, I've known Gary for a very long time.
What the hell are you doing to me?
He's cool. He really is. I guarantee it.
Victor, I understand why you're jumpy, but you don't have to be. I've been in this business 3 years. I'm not Heath. I'm not a cop. Jeez, I've known Don for years, Victor. We met in Europe years ago, running stuff across the border.
It's true, Victor. Years ago.
And then we were friends for a long time in Edmonton before Don came out here. I mean, there's really, honest, nothing for you to be afraid of.
I want to stop here for a minute. There is an issue that needs to be discussed. And in order to do so, we should know a little more about the man Don Langdon introduced as his best friend, Gary. Eventually, everyone did learn more at the trial of Victor Amato, as the Crown Attorney called his star witness.
Would you state your name and rank for the record?
My name is Gary William Godwin, G-O-D-W-I-N. I'm a constable for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police.
Constable, what were your duties on October the 3rd, 1977?
I was acting in an undercover capacity at that time.
And what was the purpose of this?
attempting to buy illicit drugs, mainly cocaine, and to gather information.
Would you please tell the court what your appearance was at this time?
Well, at that time, I had longer hair down past my ears, not quite to my shoulders. I had mutton chops, which were cut out in the middle, and a centerpiece beard in the middle, here.
Who knew you were a police constable at this time?
Only my cover team and Don Langdon.
Godwin's presence in the car on October the 3rd and his activities from this point on take us to the heart of the Amato case. The issue is entrapment. Sid Simon's defense of Amato was based on the contention that his client was an honest citizen who had been lured and trapped by the RCMP into becoming a criminal. The crime, he would argue, had been created by the state. In the United States, entrapment had long been an accepted defense. Car dealer John DeLorean had been acquitted because of it. In England, the courts had always refused to accept the defense. Before Amato, which was to become the test case, the Canadian position on the issue had never been formally decided by the Supreme Court. As we return to the story, it is important to consider events in the light of one central question. How far should the police be allowed to go? In court, Sid Simons continued his examination of his client.
Had you ever met this Gary before?
No.
All right. What happened from there?
Well, they finally talked me into not worrying about them being cops or anything. And then Gary says, "Don't worry. If you're worried about the girl, we don't have to meet her at all." So I was given $1,100 by Gary. And he said for me to leave my car keys with him in case. But Don said, "Oh, that's not necessary. I know where he lives and where he works." At that time, I was so confused and so scared. I didn't know what to do. So I just took the money and I went and I met June at another place in her car. And we drove to her house and I waited there with her daughter while June went out to get the cocaine. And about half an hour later, she came back to the house.
Okay, here it is. Take it and get it out of here. It's been weighed. It's all there. Take it back to this great new friend of yours. And Victor.
Yes, June.
Don't ever bother calling me about this sort of thing again.
Mr. Amato, did you receive any money for this transaction?
None. It was never discussed.
Did you receive any cocaine?
None. Never.
Was there any discussion about that?
Yes, there was. It happened when I got back to the car with the half ounce of cocaine.
All right, here it is. She says it's been weighed. Now you got what you want, and that's it. This is the last time. I'm not a dealer. I did this as a favor for you, Don. I'm not making anything out of it.
You're not? Well, we can fix that.
No. You don't understand.
Hey, Don, Victor should get a cut from this. Should we give him an end, half a gram to cover his head?
Sure. That's only fair.
No, you don't understand. I don't want anything. I'm trying to get the point across that this will never happen again. It's too heavy for me. I don't need this.
However culpable he may or may not have been, Victor Amato was certainly not very decisive. There was to be another transaction, but this one, as we shall see, came after pressure that made the earlier stress seem almost trivial. Don Langdon dropped out of the picture at this point, never to surface again. From now on, it was RCMP Constable Gary Godwin applying the pressure. We should note that Godwin's account of that last transaction was quite different from Amato's. Among other things, he said that Victor Amato asked for and received a half a gram of cocaine as his share or end of the transaction. In due course, we shall see what ruling the trial judge made on this issue of credibility. The prelude to the third transaction was another call to Amato's place of work.
Victor, it's Gary. Look, I'm very pleased with what went down the other night. I'd like to have a steady source here in Vancouver.
Oh, Christ, will you just... No.
Just think about it, Victor. Just tell your people we want 3 ounces for $6,000. Now, if you know anything about cocaine, you'll know that's a good price.
I don't know anything about it. I have no idea who the hell you are. I am not interested.
Victor Amato may have been indecisive, but Gary Godwin was very, very persistent. A few days later, he called again. Amato said he was busy. Godwin called right back. He called seven or eight times that day, Amato was to tell the court, and in the end he left a long-distance number for Amato to reach him, collect. Godwin was to deny that this happened, so Amato's account of it assumed some importance during the trial.
So he left a number for you to call?
Yes. It was a long distance to the interior, to the Okanagan.
All right. Did you make a call to that number?
Yes, at the end of the day. I said, look, you know, I don't know you at all. I'm not going through with what you want.
When you made this call, who did you first speak to, Gary or someone else?
An Oriental girl.
How could you tell?
Well, by her accent. She had sort of a broken Oriental accent.
And what was said between you and her?
I just asked for Gary, and she said he was in the washroom, and she asked me to hold on while she went to get him.
All right. And did he come to the phone?
Yes, he did.
This minor exchange, just one more phone call in a case with so many, actually had a real importance, because Constable Gary Godwin denied in court Victor Amato's account of his having pursued Amato with seven or eight calls a day, with long-distance calls and with other tactics we'll learn about shortly. In essence, this aspect of the case revolved around the credibility of Amato and Godwin. And when Godwin took the stand, Sid Simon zeroed in on this long-distance call.
Constable, during your days off in early October, had you been in the Okanagan?
I wonder what relevance that has, Your Honor.
Patience might demonstrate it to my friend.
I suggest what this man does on his days off is hardly relevant to this trial.
Well, he did say he wasn't working. I don't imagine it is relevant, Mr. Simon.
If I didn't think it was relevant, I wouldn't ask it, Your Honor. I'm not on a fishing trip.
Witness, do you remember where you were?
Yes, Your Honor, I do.
Was it in the Okanagan?
With all due respect, I'd rather not answer that question, Your Honor.
Well, somebody tell me why not.
It's possible he was involved in another investigation of some sort.
Perhaps if I ask the next question, this will clear itself up, Your Honor.
Well, Mr. Simons, if you know something, ask a question.
Did you phone Amato from the Okanagan area between the 3rd and the 11th of October and leave him a number at which to call you, and did he subsequently call you back at that number?
Not to the best of my recollection. At least, I don't have that in my notes.
You have no recollection of this?
I do not, no. Not at this time.
Did you have anyone answering the telephone, wherever you were, who spoke English with difficulty and who appeared to be of Oriental background, from the sound of her voice?
The place I stay might very well have had that, yes.
And where would this be?
Well, I would rather not. it was in Rutland.
So this isn't some figment of my imagination. There was such a person at Rutland during that period?
Yes, there was.
And was she a police person?
No. She was a friend of mine.
And she was visiting you in Rutland in October of 1977.
Well, at that time, she was, she would have visited me at that time, yes.
Well, can you imagine, Constable, how I would know about this, how I would know about this woman if that phone call from Victor Amato did not take place? Can you offer any explanation other than psychic inspiration on my part?
I cannot. I'm sorry, but I do not recall the phone call. I do not have it in my notes.
Very effective cross-examination. It did indeed seem obvious that for Amato to know about Godwin's Rutland phone number and his Oriental friend, that phone call must have taken place. Godwin may simply have forgotten about the call, but this would cast serious doubts on his memory, and even more important, on his police notes. Policemen, unlike most witnesses, make notes at the time of an incident and are allowed to refresh their memories in court by referring to them. If those notes are shown to be selective and incomplete, they are not only much reduced in value, they also become dangerously unfair. The fairness or appropriateness of the police conduct was, of course, at the center of the Amato case, and nowhere was this issue more clearly revealed than in the incident Amato described next.
All right, Mr. Amato, what happened after this call to the interior?
Well, a few days later, on October the 12th, he called me at work again.
Yes.
He called about eight times. I kept refusing to go to the phone. And then finally he left a message.
All right. And what was the message?
He left his phone number in Vancouver, and he asked me to call him that night, or he'd be in first thing in the morning to see me.
And did you want him coming to the shop to see you?
Not at all. Mm.
So did you call him back?
Yes, I did.
Gary here.
It's Victor Amato.
Hey, Victor, hi. Hey, man, listen.
No, you listen to me. You just stop calling me, man. I'm not answering your calls because I don't want anything to do with you. I'm washing my hands of you. I don't trust you. I don't want any part of this, okay? So just forget it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Jesus Christ, I knew it. So what are you trying to do? Don't you understand?
Cool it, Victor. Don't hang up on me. This is very important. Listen, I have some people in town, and I have to answer to these people, and they're expecting to get this 3 ounces tonight.
What? There's no possible way that's going
to
happen.
Well, these people are going to want to know why I brought them into town when there's no deal that's going to happen.
Well, that's your problem. I told you from the start this wasn't going to go on anymore.
Well, can you do me a favor? Can you give me the girl's number, and I'll do it myself? I'll keep you out of it.
No, absolutely not. That's one of the reasons I'm not carrying this any further. I don't want her getting involved anymore.
Just look, Victor, you got to understand. I am in a jam here, a real one. Now, please, please, don't hang up on me. Can I meet you somewhere? Just for a coffee. I won't get you involved. Can we just talk for 10 minutes, please? I'm really, really on the spot. Now, I will meet you anywhere you like.
Danny's on Marine Drive. Half an hour.
Victor, I'm over here.
Hi, Gary.
God, am I glad you're here. I'm in such a jam with these guys, I can't tell you.
You want menu?
No, just a coffee thing.
Yeah, same here.
Look, Gary, you may be in a jam, but I don't know what it has to do with me. I mean, I'm sorry, but it was Don who got me into this just to do him a favor, and all of a sudden I'm left with someone I don't even know, and frankly, I'm very scared. I just don't trust... I don't know what to think.
I know, I understand. These guys I'm talking about, they're in town now, but I didn't bring them here because I know how you feel.
Gary, the amount of money you're talking...
I mean, this is crazy. This is way beyond...
Don't
worry about that. Don't get uptight about the amount. I'm very careful. I don't screw around. And I always deal with guns.
God, oh, for God's
sake. Victor, I'm just trying to tell you there is nothing to worry about. It's just that I'm in this jam with these three guys. They're big dealers. And I called them into town, and they're expecting to do a deal tonight.
Gary, I'm a hairdresser. I don't want to...
Just do me a favor. It's like, if we don't do the deal tonight, these guys are going to be coming down to see you tomorrow.
What?
I mean, I told you this was a jam.
They'll be coming to the shop?
I'm afraid so. These are big dealers, Victor.
Well, I'll give her a call, see what I can get arranged.
It is perhaps unnecessary for me to point out that none of what Constable Gary Godwin was saying here was true. From this point, events proceeded to a rapid and perhaps predictable conclusion. Amato made 2 phone calls to June Lee and persuaded her to obtain the cocaine for Godwin. About 11 o'clock that night, a deal was made for 2.5 ounces of cocaine for $4,900. Godwin refused to give Amato the money in advance, as he had done the last time, and so he succeeded in being taken to June Lee's house and meeting her when the deal was made. Once more, Amato said he received no money and no cocaine for the transaction. This was the last deal. Shortly thereafter, Amato and Lee were arrested and charged with trafficking in narcotics. It should be noted that when he was called to the stand, Constable Godwin painted a very different picture of Victor Amato. His version of that last conversation at Denny's restaurant was based on his notes. These notes, which we have already had occasion to consider, were filed as an exhibit in the trial.
Notes started approximately 1:15 a.m., 13th October, 1977. Victor called me at approximately 7 p.m., 12th of October, 1977, and advised me to meet him at Denny's restaurant. I told him I would have to talk to him before we did anything tonight, and he agreed we'd talk.
Yeah, listen, Victor, the reason I want to talk to you is because I want 3 ounces of coke. Can your connection do this? Like, I have some people in, my people, and I told them I could do 3 ounces tonight.
Well, I have to call abroad about 3 ounces. Maybe we'll have to do it tomorrow. Is that okay?
No. They're leaving tomorrow morning, eh? Like I need it tonight.
Well, I'll phone her, see what she can do.
Victor and I had further general drug conversation, and then Victor went to phone. He went to the back where the payphones were. He then reappeared, saying he would go elsewhere to make his call. I went to the payphones and placed a call to Constable Bennett, advising him of our conversation to date. Victor returned approximately 10 minutes later, and we moved to another booth.
Yeah, she said she could probably put it together tonight.
Good. What does she want for 3 ounces?
$6,100.
Oh, that's pretty high. What will the quality be like?
Same as last time, if not better. But never worse.
Well, I'll offer... No. No, on the other hand, I'd better call my friends. I'll be right back.
Okay.
I left Victor and went to the payphone right next to us and called Constable Bennett. I discussed price with him, and we agreed on $5,700. I returned to the table with Victor. I told him this price. He then went to the payphone and called. He returned and sat down with me.
She says $5,900. Well, it's better than the last stuff. She can't go any lower. She gets no end herself.
Well, 59 is a little steep. I don't know if they'll go for it.
The following conversation was recalled when I was reviewing my notes at 10 a.m. 13th of October, 1977.
Now, what about my end?
Well, if you can do it tonight.
Like it's the same as last time, eh? She's not taking care of my end.
Yeah, well, how does 2 grams sound? As long as you take it out before, I don't want to be fucking around with stuff in the car.
Yeah, that's okay.
This was Godwin's version of events. If, in fact, it had been accepted, the Amato case wouldn't even merit a footnote in Canadian legal history. But the fact is, it was not accepted. Before rendering his verdict in the case, the trial judge made the following critical ruling.
The evidence tendered by the Crown would lead one to believe that the accused was ready, willing, and able to traffic in cocaine with a member of the RCMP acting in an undercover capacity. The evidence tendered by the defense would lead one to believe that the accused did in fact traffic cocaine, but that he was forced to do so due to the pressure applied by an informer and by an undercover officer. In the present case, the Crown was unable to produce the witness who originally arranged for Constable Godwin to meet the accused, Amato. His evidence would have been extremely useful to me. He could have corroborated the evidence of the Crown, or he could have corroborated the evidence of the defense. I believe he should have been called by the Crown. His absence has restricted the defense from making a full answer to the charge. And for that reason, I am prepared to assume that my findings of fact ought to be made on the basis of the evidence tendered by the defense.
This was an essential and a fascinating ruling for many reasons. The legal impact of what the judge had done was enormous. It turned the Amato trial into an absolutely perfect test case for the defense of entrapment in Canada. In effect, it said as follows. Victor Amato, I believe everything you have told me. I must now decide if that allows you to avail yourself of the defense of entrapment. And on that issue, Judge McGivern rendered the following judgment.
The defense submits that the actions of the undercover officer, as well as the actions of the paid informer, amount to entrapment, and therefore the accused should be acquitted. In order to raise the defense of entrapment, there must be evidence that the police had instigated the crime. And had they not done so, the accused would not have been involved in the transaction. The instigation must, of course, go beyond mere solicitation or decoy work. The accused was, in my opinion, actively solicited to participate in an activity which he knew to be unlawful. I'm satisfied, however, that the evidence falls far short of the evidence required at law to establish the defense of entrapment. The evidence amounts to no more than persistent solicitation to persuade the accused to engage in the trafficking of cocaine. I find the accused guilty as charged.
And so the trial judge seemed to be of the view that entrapment was a possible defense in Canada, but that this case did not represent a police-instigated crime, merely a case of acceptable police solicitation. Amato was convicted. So too was June Lee, who had, it appears, also been involved in a completely different trafficking incident
shortly after this one. She ended up being sentenced to 2 years less one day for all of the offenses for which she was charged. With respect to Amato, the trial judge agreed with Sid Simon's submission that the police solicitation was very relevant in sentencing, and he did not impose a jail sentence. Amato was fined $3,000 and placed on probation for 2 years, a sentence which clearly reflected the judge's negative view of the police behavior in this case. Nonetheless, Amato now had a criminal record, and the British Columbia Court of Appeal soon had a major case on their hands. They made short, unanimous work of it. Mr. Justice Taggart ruled as follows.
I am not persuaded that the evidence to which we have been referred by counsel for the appellant does other than support the conclusion reached by the trial judge. Be that as it may, I think we are precluded by previous judgments in this court and in the Ontario Court of Appeal, where the view was expressed that there is no defense of entrapment. I think we ought to follow this view until such time as the matter is definitely settled by the Supreme Court of Canada.
As clear an invitation to the Supreme Court as could possibly be given, Mr. Justice Seaton, in his concurring judgment, was even more forceful.
I agree that the appeal should be dismissed. I wish to add this. I do not come reluctantly to the conclusion that there's no such thing as a defense of entrapment. I favor the English approach to this over the approach in the United States. In my view, the court should try the accused, not the police. I do not accept entrapment as such to be a defense.
To no one's surprise, the Supreme Court of Canada granted Sid Simon's leave to take the matter up to Ottawa. On August the 9th, 1982, Canada's highest court handed down judgment. Their ruling represented perhaps the most balanced division of opinion in the long history of the Supreme Court. Mr. Justice Dixon wrote one opinion, concurred in by three other judges.
I am of the opinion that on the facts of this case, the defense of entrapment, assuming it to be available under Canadian law, does not arise. The four British Columbia judges before whom the matter has come have been unanimous in concluding this. It does not seem to me to fall to this court to retry the case and arrive at different findings. I would dismiss the appeal.
In short, these four judges refused to address the larger issue of whether entrapment did apply in Canada. Mr. Justice Estey, whose reasoning was also concurred in by three other judges, including Chief Justice Laskin, took an entirely different approach. In a lengthy, careful decision, he considered the issue of entrapment as a whole.
The proponents of this defense generally seek to advance it as something necessary to bring fairness or fundamental justice into criminal law. In my respectful view, the true issue is the avoidance of the improper invocation by the state of the judicial process where the accused has been ensnared by the police force in order to bring about an offense. The repugnance which must be felt by the court on being implicated in a process so shameful on the part of the state cannot be dissipated by the registration of a conviction and then the imposition thereafter of even a minimum sentence. I am of the view that it is open to this court to recognize a defense of entrapment and to give effect to it in proper cases. The conduct of the police in this case, in my view, clearly gives rise to entrapment. It is the plain fact that the drug trafficking which occurred was promoted by the police at a time when they had no reason to suspect, let alone believe, that the accused was in any way related to such activity. The cumulative effect of such behavior by the police would, in my view, be viewed by the community as shocking and outrageous. For all of these reasons, I would recognize the defense of entrapment and apply it to the case before us. I would allow the appeal, set aside the conviction, and direct a stay of prosecution.
And so, four judges had avoided the larger issue and confirmed Amato's conviction, and four others had recognized entrapment and overturned that conviction. The scales had never been more precisely balanced. The final decision lay in the hands of the Ninth Justice, Mr. Justice Ritchie.
Although there is no authoritative judgment in Canada on the issue of entrapment, the weight of authority is to the effect that in a case where the crime in question would not have been committed save for the calculated inveigling or persistent importuning of the police, then the defense of entrapment may be established.
And so, quite simply, Mr. Justice Ritchie accepted the existence of the defense in Canada, which meant that 5 of the 9 judges had. Entrapment, as of this moment, became a recognized defense in this country. But what about the Amato case itself? What about Victor Amato? Did this case display the factors required for that defense?
Whether the activities of the police can be said to amount to the calculated inveigling or persistent importuning required must depend on the facts of each case. In the present case, although drug transactions were suggested to Amato by an agent provocateur, this is not in itself enough to invoke the defense of entrapment. In my view, it is only where police tactics leave no room for the formation of independent criminal intent by the accused that the question of entrapment arises. I would dismiss the appeal.
And so, Mr. Justice Ritchie had crossed to the other side of the fence and joined the 4 judges who upheld Amato's conviction. Where does that leave us? Well, it certainly leaves Victor Amato with a criminal record, something I find profoundly disturbing and unfair. If the outrageous circumstances of this case do not amount to entrapment, I'm not honestly sure what facts will. On the other hand, I think something very positive did emerge from the Amato case. By that narrow 5-4 margin, the Supreme Court, in my opinion, sent out a signal to the courts of this country that the defense of entrapment is available now in Canada. That may not be of much use to Victor Amato, but I would suggest it is of very great importance to the rest of us.
You have heard the true story of Snow Job, an episode in our series, The Scales of Justice, recreating real events in Canadian crime. The script was by Guy Gavriel Kay, and the commentary by the Toronto lawyer, Edward L. Greenspan, QC. In the cast, you have heard Jeff Bowes as Victor Amato and Ray Stancer as his lawyer, Sid Simon. The trial judge was played by Henry Raymer and the Crown Attorney by Neil Monroe. The undercover agents Don Langvin and Gary Godwin were played by Booth Savage and Michael Hogan, with Mary Long as Amato's co-accused, June Lee. You have also heard Melanie Brown, Jim Henshaw, Ron Hartman, Arch McDonald, Frank Perry, Ken Pogue, Paul Soule, and Marion Waldman. RCMP Corporal Tate was played by Lawrence Dane. Technical operations were by Derek Stubbs, and sound effects by Stephanie McKenna. The production assistant was Nina Callahan, the music consultant Stephanie McKenna, and the casting director Ann Weldon Tate, with the assistance of Catherine Kester. The associate producer is Guy Gavriel Kay. The Scales of Justice is produced in Toronto by George Jonas. This is Fred Napoli speaking. Next week, we showcase Jack Batten's recreation of the dramatic circumstances surrounding the extradition in Toronto of Kathy Smith for the alleged murder in California of comedian John Belushi on the Scales of Justice.